ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 9th of December. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, Studio Wars. Netflix faces off with old Hollywood in a hostile bidding war set to reshape the global media industry. And the travelling music teacher who helps long-silent regional schools hit the right note again.
That is the best part of my career. It's my favourite part of teaching, is watching their faces when they succeed at doing something. It is just pure joy and happiness.
It's the last rates decision of the year today, and with inflation still unwieldy, families trying to save their dollars this Christmas may be disappointed, not only with yesterday's announcement that the federal energy rebates will cease, but with the news widely expected from Michelle Bullock this afternoon. Our business correspondent is David Taylor. David, what are we expecting the Reserve Bank to do with interest rates later today?
In short, Andy, nothing. The cash rate will stay at 3.6%. And I say will rather than may, because everyone is expecting the Reserve Bank to keep interest rates unchanged for the simple reason that nothing has really changed over the past 4 weeks following a worse than expected inflation figure. So all eyes are on what the Reserve Bank governor will say this afternoon, but rates on hold today.
It really wasn't long ago that most economists were forecasting one or two more interest rate cuts over the next 12 months. We've had the cessation of the federal energy rebates yesterday. It's not looking like a terribly cheery Christmas for most people who owe money or are trying to feed their family.
That's right. And look, a third of households are paying off a mortgage, so not getting that relief will be disappointing. But also, landlords passing on rental increases as their mortgage repayments continue to be cumbersome. Around two-thirds of all households will feel the pain in some respect. But let's just go through this methodically. You mentioned the energy relief and energy rebates coming off. That will ensure that households will continue to pay the full price for their energy consumption, which has been a large increase. And in the latest CPI data that we got, it really showed that electricity price hikes, even gas price hikes, are really hurting the hip pocket. So that pain will get slightly worse, which will contribute to inflation. But it's not just that. It's rental prices as well. We've still got vacancy rates that are way too low. Housing supply is failing to keep up. So rental prices are still a sting for younger Australians. Out-of-pocket healthcare costs are still a problem. And of course, insurance. Now, if you add all that together, you've got this idea of sticky services inflation that has not just stopped in terms of its, there was some hope that it was loosening a little bit, but it's actually gotten more sticky over the past 4 weeks. The latest CPI data shows inflation at around 3.8%. So it's going the wrong direction. The Reserve Bank wants it to be somewhere between 2 and 3%, ideally 2.5%. So the inflation picture is not great. But then, Andy, add to that the fact that unemployment at 4.4%, it's still a little bit elevated from where it was earlier in the year, but 4.4%, the Reserve Bank says, is still slightly tight, which means that workers can bargain potentially for higher pay. And this is where this idea of productivity comes in, because productivity in Australia is at the moment too low. It's climbing, but very slowly. Now, in order for the wage rises that workers are receiving to be justified, productivity needs to grow even stronger, because per unit labour costs with too low productivity are too high. Putting it in very simple terms, Andy, it means that as workers' wages rise, if a firm isn't productive enough, bosses usually have to pass on those higher wages with increases in customer prices. So the picture there is ugly.
The current Reserve Bank governor is reluctant, understandably, to make long-range predictions. But when she gives the reasoning behind the board's decision later this afternoon, there'll be some key words we're listening out for. What are they?
100%. And one of the key words will be uncertainty. Other journalists have commented on the fact that the Reserve Bank governor uses the word uncertainty several times in the statement and in the statement on monetary policy that accompanies the decision. But look, we're looking for things like a tight labour market or elevated inflation, words like that to indicate that the Reserve Bank is going to be looking next year for signs that inflation is cooling. And if it's not, Andy, the next move in interest rates, could well be up.
David Taylor. Our submarine defence deal with the US and the UK is apparently full steam ahead after the US review into AUKUS. Australia's defence and foreign ministers are in the US meeting their American counterparts. And while the deal or the detail of the deal and the long-awaited review is not being made public, US officials say it will be expanded and strengthened. Here's Nicole Johnston.
For both joining us here today. This is an incredibly strong alliance.
After months of uncertainty, a message of reassurance from Australia's key ally, delivered by Marco Rubio, US Secretary of State.
This is a very strong partnership. It's a strong alliance. And what we want to do is continue to build on it. We think we have a lot of momentum behind this alliance.
And so does Australia. Foreign Minister Penny Wong.
A win for Australia, a win for the US and a win for the United Kingdom. And we welcome President Trump's statement. We are full steam ahead. We are full steam ahead.
And more steam from the US Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth.
As was mentioned, full steam ahead on AUKUS. We applaud Australia's upcoming delivery of an additional $1 billion to help expand US submarine production capacity.
For a while, there was a worry that US President Donald Trump wasn't a fan of AUKUS. That's the Australian, UK and US defence agreement. The pact is aimed at keeping the Indo-Pacific free and open and to counter China's growing naval power in the region. The US had been reviewing AUKUS for 6 months. The report hasn't been released publicly, but all parties say they're on board and the timeline has been confirmed. Also on this week in Washington, D.C. is AUSMIN, an annual meeting between the U.S. and Australian foreign and defence ministers. Jennifer Parker is an expert associate at the Australian National University.
It's a big deal this week because it's the first AUSMIN where we've had our foreign minister and defence minister sitting down with the new U.S. defence secretary and U.S. secretary of state under the Trump administration. And a lot has changed since the last AUSMIN 12 months ago.
So what should Australia be trying to get out of it this week?
Look, I think Australia needs to reassert its importance in the Indo-Pacific, and AUSMIN is a great way to do that. I think Australia also needs to be having clear conversations with our major ally about what the changing world means for Australia and what Australia is responsible for and what we expect of our allies.
Last week, the U.S. released its national security strategy. There was limited mention of Australia in it. Is that because we're such an insignificant player in the eyes of the United States?
I think it means that the US is not so concerned about Australia. It's got problems all around the world that it was thinking about its national security strategy. And it thinks the alliance between Australia and the US is strong. There were some warnings in it for us, though. There was one around Australia needing to address this issue with defence spending, and the US is on record saying that we need to increase it. That was in the national security strategy. And there was another one about our economic relationship with China.
And on that issue of China, the United States is clearly doubling down on trying to counter it. Australia does have this delicate relationship and balance with China. But is that something that could get Australia in trouble with President Trump in the future?
Look, I think that our economic dependence on China gets us in trouble at times, and we experience the economic coercion from China from 2020 to 2022. I think increasingly, as the world becomes more unstable, and China being one of the countries who is using their growing military might to achieve its foreign policy aims through military projection of power, is going to be a challenge for Australia. And this is something that Australia needs to think about.
And so subs are on the way. Three US Virginia-class nuclear-powered submarines should turn up in Australia sometime in the 2030s at an estimated cost of around $5 billion US dollars each. Pete Hegseth says it's all about achieving peace through strength.
The stronger we are together, the more we can deter the kinds of conflicts neither of us want to see, and this is a deepening of that partnership. Grateful to be here. Thank you.
The US Secretary of War Pete Hegseth ending that report by Nicole Johnston. It's a deal that could really reshape Hollywood and the global news and entertainment industry. Media giant Paramount Skydance has mounted a hostile takeover bid for Hollywood movie house Warner Brothers just days after relatively new player streaming company Netflix had agreed to buy it. It'll be the biggest media deal in many years, and President Trump says he wants to be involved. Rachel Mealy has the story.
A very big hello and welcome to a very special evening.
It's already playing out a bit like a Hollywood movie. With Netflix's offer on the table for Warner Brothers shareholders, the storyline took a dramatic turn.
This is the first time that a president of the United States has ever hosted this phenomenal event. I don't know why I'm doing it.
On Sunday night, Paramount boss David Ellison sat in the presidential box at the Kennedy Center. During intermission, he may have mentioned to the president that his company was about to launch a hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers in a bid to push Netflix out of the picture. Donald Trump insists he doesn't favour one side over the other.
I know the companies very well. I know what they're doing, but I have to see. I have to see what percentage of market they have. We have to see the Netflix percentage of market, Paramount, the percentage of market. I mean, none of them are particularly great friends of mine. I want to do what's right.
But in another plot twist, it turns out Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has been raising money to support Paramount's bid. Donald Trump says he's only spoken to Jared Kushner about the peace deal in Gaza.
He's really trying to work on Gaza. I think Gaza's his primary thing is Gaza.
Last week, Netflix launched a bid of more than $100 billion to buy out Warner Brothers Discovery's TV and film studios. But now that deal's been trumped by Paramount's $163 billion hostile takeover for Warner Brothers. Dawn Shimoleski is the US entertainment business correspondent at Reuters.
It is a pure cash offer, $30 a share, which is, by contrast, Netflix has offered around $28 a share.
Netflix is the market leader in the world of streaming and wants to buy Warner Brothers because of its vast library of content. The Netflix proposal would see it spin off the rest of the Warner Brothers empire, which includes the news channel CNN, into a separate company. Dawn Shimoleski says Netflix's vision is completely focused on entertainment and streaming.
Netflix is saying, look, this will be terrific. We'll continue to release movies, but we also have a streaming service that can help expose people to HBO content. You know, we've got a big global reach, so this would be great for everyone concerned. And Paramount, you know, is arguing it'll have a monopoly control over streaming and everyone will pay more. It's a really interesting battle that's shaping up.
Jeremy Barr is the media writer for The Guardian. He says the Paramount deal has implications for news media in the US because it owns the CBS network.
And of course, if you have the Paramount deal go through, then we're looking at this big impact on CNN, because we expect that means that there would be a merger, a sort of a melding of CBS News and CNN. And people here are, I think people at CNN are nervous about that. People at CBS News are nervous because they're worried about losing their job. There's just, whenever you have two TV networks merging, there's always going to be cost cuts. But in this particular case, CBS News has gotten, you know, more controversial with Barry Weiss, who is the new editor-in-chief of it. And there's sort of a general perception that CBS is more favorable to Trump these days. So there's a concern that if that merger goes through, and then CBS, you know, Paramount takes over CNN, then what if they shift CNN more to the right?
The Guardian's media writer, Jeremy Barr, ending that report by Rachel Mealy. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Back home, and the Victorian government has made a formal apology to First Nations people, today acknowledging past and ongoing injustices and harm stemming from colonisation. It's one of its first public acts to follow the signing of a treaty with Victoria's Aboriginal people last month, the first to be signed between First Nations people and an Australian government. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
A smoking ceremony on the steps of Victoria's Parliament. Members of the First Peoples Assembly gathered with Aboriginal leaders and community members ahead of the apology. Gunditjmara woman Dr. Jill Gallagher AO was Victoria's inaugural Treaty Commissioner.
Today is the beginning of the Victorian government acknowledging that we were here first.
Auntie Jill says it's a day of healing.
There were crimes against humanity committed on our people in the name of colonisation, and we need that acknowledgement.
In a special sitting of Parliament today, Victorian Premier Jacinta Allan delivered the address.
Decisions made in this Parliament over its long history have long denied the First Peoples of this land their rights and their self-determination. Today, this Parliament becomes a place of reckoning, and that reckoning has meaning for all of us who call Victoria home. We acknowledge the harm inflicted on generations of First Peoples and mark the beginning of a new era.
There have been formal apologies made to First Nations people in every state and territory, including Victoria. In 1997, then Premier Jeff Kennett delivered an apology to members of the Stolen Generations. And in 2008, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd issued a national apology for harmful past policies, including child removal. Today's apology was negotiated as part of the state's treaty agreement and was a key recommendation of the Yurok Justice Commission, which was Australia's first inquiry into historic and ongoing injustices against Aboriginal people. Natalie Hutchins is Victoria's Minister for Treaty and First Peoples.
Yes, apologies have happened on a federal level and by a previous state premier, only in relation to limited matters like Stolen Generations. Our apology today is around acknowledging the findings that have come through Yurok, the injustices that have happened caused by government policy time and time again, and have had huge effects on our First Nations peoples.
Victoria's opposition leader, Jess Wilson, says the coalition couldn't support the apology because it includes references to treaty, which the coalition has vowed to repeal if elected.
We have a difference of opinion. We have a difference of position on the treaty that is well known. And unfortunately, the government has now put forward a motion that we cannot support, despite the fact that we understand the importance of the apology today.
Victoria's treaty was signed into law last month, enshrining an independent body to represent Aboriginal people in the state and advise on policy. The Victorian government will also be held to account on outcomes relating to First Nations people.
Bridget Fitzgerald and Kathleen O'Connor with that report. Tough new rules have been flagged for short-stay accommodation in Brisbane in a bid to free up homes for those who need them and to shift tourism to the city. Brisbane City Council is following the lead of other Australian towns and cities in trying to regulate Airbnb-style accommodation by introducing new permit schemes and a three-strikes policy. But experts and residents from areas that already have a permit system are warning the new rules could have limited impact. Stephanie Smale.
Travellers have been using short-stay accommodation as an alternative to hotels and motels for years. But like many jurisdictions, the rules in Brisbane have been pretty relaxed.
We don't actually have a formal scheme at the moment.
Brisbane Councillor Sarah Hutton wants to change that. She explains the council wants to make it harder for short-stay accommodation to operate in the city's lower-density suburbs.
We suspect that there are almost 500 properties that probably won't be able to get the correct approvals to be able to undertake short-term accommodation in their property. So we're really hopeful that these will go back to the long-term rental market and hopefully relieve a little bit of the pressure on the current housing crisis.
Councillor Hutton acknowledges the current system relies on short-stay operators self-reporting, with those who do come clean paying higher rates. Around 2,100 properties in the Brisbane area are currently registered as short-stay accommodation, but the council suspects there are more. Councillor Hutton says a new permit system could help stop that.
If you advertise, you'll be required to acknowledge your permit number on the advertisement. And so we'll obviously have to work quite closely with the platform operators to ensure that if people are advertising without that permit, that we are made aware of it.
Under the proposal, owners who operate without a permit could be fined more than $140,000.
So it forces people to go underground, and unless councils police it and check for the compliance, then you will have people go rogue.
The proposal prompted a mixed response from callers to ABC Local Radio. Some say similar changes in the holiday hotspot Noosa, north of Brisbane, have worked to control existing short-stay accommodation, but also created other issues, like fueling the housing crisis.
People that have the SDA permits, their properties are inflated in prices, and those that don't have it, their real estate prices are actually down.
Others have welcomed the move.
I can't understand why it's taken so long, but I congratulate council 10 times over if they get this through.
I do think it's surprising that we've been so slow.
University of Sydney Professor of Urban and Regional Planning Nicole Gurran says it's about time cities like Brisbane scrutinise short-term stays.
Not only slow, but very timid and laissez-faire in our responses if we compare ourselves to international jurisdictions. Short-term rentals have been around for a decade, and concerns about inadequate housing supply and rental housing supply have also, you know, been around for a decade.
How has cracking down on Airbnbs in other parts of the country made a difference, or has it?
It's difficult to get measures because the housing market is complex and there's a lot of factors weighing on demand and a lot of factors weighing on supply. But certainly there is evidence that when you reduce the number of short-term rentals, overall vacancy rates improve.
The proposed changes will go out to consultation this week, with the council hoping to have them in place by July next year.
Stephanie Smale. They say silence is golden, but not in a music classroom. After years of collecting dust, instruments in a couple of regional Queensland schools are once again making beautiful music. It's all thanks to one travelling music teacher who's sharing her passion with students who'd otherwise not get the chance. Grace Whiteside prepared this report.
Can you play me your B flat? Play it together. That sounds nicer. All right, whenever you're ready.
The classroom is Tina Greenfield's happy place. Today, she's teaching music at Monto State School, about 6 hours' drive north of Brisbane, one of five schools in the North Burnett region she visits each week.
And once they get it, it is just like jumping for joy. That it's just like, that is the best part of my career. My favourite part of teaching is watching their faces when they succeed at doing something. It is just pure joy and happiness.
For years, these schools have been unable to offer a permanent music program due to a lack of trained staff. It's a gap that Tina Greenfield has been trying to fill and involves her travelling nearly 350 kilometres a week across the region. She teaches about 80 students in percussion, brass and woodwind instruments and says it's all about teamwork.
So every single child is part of an ensemble, so they have to be part of band. And that means I've got high schoolers working with primary school kids, which is really fun. And then we also get to work on, you know, playing music together and working on a lot of different skills that go over across into their classroom and helps develop their focus and all these other benefits that come from just learning an instrument.
Really confident with how it goes?
Yeah.
Yeah, here we go.
And it's not all about hitting the right notes. These students say there are many lessons to learn.
Well, some people who are nervous of, like, performing, sometimes an instrument can get them out there, make them feel more confident.
It gives you a great experience. It opens you up to, like, different talents that you didn't have before or you never knew that you had.
For some of these kids, this is the only opportunity they have to learn music. Troy Jenkins is the principal of Monto State School.
The biggest value is our kids don't have a music teacher just down the road that they can access privately. So our department, instrumental music teacher, provides that service free of charge to our kids. They're able to learn an instrument of their choice, but they're also able to participate in that band element and become immersed in that arts culture that we just can't get in a rural town.
He says teachers like Tina Greenfield are making a big difference for regional kids.
She is the one that has driven the revitalisation of the program and got the children involved. So it comes down to the person. If we don't have the person, we don't have the program.
You're going to have Frère Jacques on the mind for the rest of the day. Monto State School Principal Troy Jenkins ending that report by Grace Whiteside. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. A string of serious injuries and deaths in e-bike crashes, particularly among children, is fueling calls for a crackdown across the country. Today, Jeff Rose from the Monash Institute of Transport Studies on the influx of illegal e-bikes on the roads and what can be done about it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.